once again we are standing on the stage observing another act of the vast human comedy. The human comedy that plays on and on and on and on and on and has laugh after laugh after laugh, generation after generation, eon after... But then again, some people call it the human tragedy. Or as one of my friends used to say, the human tragedy. I'm not so sure whether it is a tragedy. Is it a tragedy, really? Is it a comedy? Oh, Pagliacci, sing eternally of your sorrows. Laugh in the great veil of tears that are surrounded. Ali Pagliacci! Ali Pagliacci! Oh, what a sad and woeful creature am I. Oh, oh, wailing eternally to the stars. Oh, calling aloud for surcease from this terrible, terrible trap. When, oh, when, oh, when shall sanity and beauty come full circle so that mankind can finally achieve the great goal of Olympus that it so long ago failed in achieve? Oh, ye Pagliacci, bring it up there. Let's go. All right, there. Hang on there. It's not bad. Ali Pagliacci. It's hard on the throat. It's not easy maintaining this tragedy, I'll tell you. It's certainly tough. I remember one time I'm standing back in the wings, and this immense tenor is doing Pagliacci. And I think one of the great educational things that you could ever do in your life is to stand in the wings when grand opera is being performed. You never in your life saw more sweating and snorting. And really, there's nothing more impressive than to see a Siegfried wearing a set of plastic horns, a Siegfried mounting higher and higher on this mountain, you see, that's made out of what appears to be papier-mâché. He's getting higher and higher, and out comes this enormous Wagnerian soprano, or whatever it is they are, and she is carrying a spear. And the spear is made of foam rubber, you see, so it doesn't stick anybody. And she's sweating profusely. He's leaving a trail of sweat. And I'll tell you, you learn something about it. And all the way, you see out there in the darkness, 87 million people sitting there laughing it up. And somehow it's transporting them to higher depths, or lower depths, or higher peaks, or what is it? I don't know. I've never quite been able to figure that out. You know, the aestheticians, these guys who study beauty, Now, these are not beauty operators. They don't fool around with the upswept thing and the bouffant. Aestheticians have never quite been able to understand, or never quite been able to get to, what is known as beauty. You know, what it is. What it is that may people go off into this transport about. And I remember one night standing in the wings, and this giant tenor, and he's wearing a clown suit. And it's an operatic clown suit, which is different. No clown ever dresses in the kind of clown suits that they do in paintings, or they do in opera. You know, that big white kind of suit with the big black buttons. They have the big thing with the big hat. Now, they don't wear that. Have you ever seen a clown dressed like that in the circus? No, they don't dress like that in the circus. See, that is the symbolic clown, and he's a giant tenor, great big fat slob. And this guy put away more spaghetti. This guy was really a shoveler. I had dinner with him afterwards. You know, you always hear about operatic people eating. You never saw anything like it. Oh, I'll tell you, they really shovel it in. Four loaves of Italian bread and eight bottles of wine. And, you know, he's really... So he's now doing his performance after the meal, not before, after. So he goes out there, and I'm standing in the wings. And he was having a little trouble. You could see that the spaghetti was working one way and the wine was working the other. And he's having trouble. You know, once in a while when you have the rumblings and the... anyway, he's out there and he's going... it was a very embarrassing moment there. I'm standing about 9 feet away and he's bellowing and booming around. And there is this girl standing behind me. She's going to do the scene in a minute. You know, she's the tragic heroine. And she says, look at that fat slob. And I turn around, and she weighed at least 340 pounds. You know, she says, look at that fat slob. You'd think that he'd keep himself in condition. And I can hear, ah, yeah. Pow, pow. Well, after a while, you know, when you get too close to things, you begin to see that there is far more comedy than tragedy in anything that we have around. And the greater the tragedy, usually the greater the comedy. Oh, fat slob. And he finishes his aria, and he comes reeling off stage, you know, and he comes staggering off stage. There's this great thunderous applause out there from the people, and he comes off and he's sweating profusely, and as he comes off stage, this other one, you know, the tragic heroine there, she gives him a look of absolute fantastic scorn. There is nothing like the bared fangs of an operatic soprano, let me tell you. She gives him this look of scorn. Obviously, he had scored too high tonight. You could hear the people out there, oh, yeah, bravo, bravo, bravissimo. They're yelling, and you know, the nuts, the opera nuts, oh, bravo, bravo, altruissimo. And they're yelling, hollering. And he comes off stage in the moment of his great triumph, and he lets go an enormous belch, blah, when he gets off stage. He comes off, and this girl looks at him, this girl, I don't know, you know, this barrage balloon, gives him a real, ooh, boy, what a cold, beady-eyed stare. And then, without batting an eyelash, she goes sailing out in full steam. Now, she's going to do it. And she goes, and he stands there in the wings, and he's looking out then, and he's sweating, and I'm standing next to him, seeing his sweat is pouring. And he looks, and he says, here's a fat slob. Oh, look at that fat slob. A pig. A pig. He thinks she is a singer. Ha, ha. Holy fire. And of course, that night the reviews came out that says once again a touching, transcendent performance of Pagliacci was observed on the great vast boards. I sure did observe a touching performance. It was a great performance. And I don't know what to say here except to say that almost invariably, wherever I've been around great tragedy, it has been far funnier than you could possibly, you know, it's a gas. Like one night, I by mistake opened the door to Mephistopheles' dressing room, and Mephistopheles and Faustus, they had this Mephistopheles who was at least 6.5 feet tall. He was the very epitome of the devil himself, and there was this great scene in Faustus when Mephistopheles appears. You ever seen that scene? You ever? Oh, it's fantastic. It's a great moment in opera. And the music was... And Faust is... He's out there saying, I will sell my soul to the devil. And he's going like that. If only I hope all my youth, my flitter. And then suddenly... there's a big roar of smoke and a giant flash. And a red light flares and the place is dark. Of course, he's in his study. And rising from the floor is Mephistopheles. And he comes rising with a smoke flaring, and he's got this big, long, black cape, and he's wearing this red suit, very fantastic costume, and he's got a black, tight hat, you know, the kind with little peaks on top, and an enormous mustache that's cut to the little thin, fine lines at the end, and a goatee, and the light plays on his face, and he sings his famous aria, and he's singing to him about, okay, you've sold your soul to the devil, let us make a deal. And of course, at that time, Faust falls down, and he is knocked to the floor by this fantastic sight of Mephistopheles appearing. I know that it would get me, too, I'll admit, that if I'm sitting down in the office, you know, and I says, oh, boy, many's the time I've sat at the desk and saying, I wish somebody would come. You know, they're always talking about selling out. Well, I'm ready to sell, and nobody's come around with a price or nothing, any kind of an offer. Hey, make an offer, you know? And I'm sitting there at the desk, and all of a sudden, out of the air conditioner, and the smoke swirls over Barry Farber's desk, and it rolls past Martha Dean's door, you know, and there's Mephistopheles in the guise of a network official. He says, smoke and flame. He says, you want to sell your soul to the devil? Well, I am here to make an offer. Eternal youth, eternal fame, and dough beyond all of your wildest dreams. A cover of life on a cover on time. And maybe even, perhaps, who knows, the Nobel Prize. Yeah. What do I do? What do I do? Ah, sign this paper. We have a little show called Guess the Whoopee. And it's a little quiz show. It will be just a little simple fun. Stars Betsy Palmer and Ollie and Francis and all the Whoopee fun people. And you will be the MC. Sign on the dotted line. Yeah. Where's the dotted line? Quick, guess the Whoopee? Yeah, well, that sounds like fun. Yes. Now, my name is Mephistopheles. And I'm here. I'll sign under your signature. Sign in blood. Give me your hand. Sign with the stagger. Yes, sign on the dotted line. I represent William Morris. That's a very good singing there tonight. Speaking of the devil, this is WOR, AM and FM in New York. This is the station. Yes, there are some stations that sell friendliness. There are some stations that sell personality. This is the only station in the Western Hemisphere that sells it.
Come with me. Aha, good evening,
monsieur.
Yes. Who is the airman? Your regular table is waiting.
Bring on the headman. My name is Mephistopheles.
May I take the lady's coat?
Indeed, he must. Oh, yes. I'm going to take a lot more. Yes,
the usual, monsieur?
Yes. The usual.
The unusual.
Yes, indeed.
That's the taste of an ale man and a Ballantine ale. Bolder, keener, more to the point.
Yes.
Next time you order up enjoyment, be a man about
real
it.
Real enjoyment.
A Ballantine ale man.
And this little scene is photographed in living color in a dark, smoky den in my house.
Three out of four men. Every time you choose the motor, Keener taking it.
Okay. Well, that's moved. Phew. I never thought they served ale there, especially Ballantine. Well, let's get on with the commercials here. We got a commercial here. New commercial here for this place. Let's see, it says, who's your tailor? Who's the man you get your clothes from? Who's the man that can make your suit feel good or look good? Why, only a tailor who makes custom-made suits cares. But now you no longer have to pay $135 for a custom-tailored suit. That's right. Now you can have the finest detailed custom suit in the style you select with the details you prefer, and not for $135. Yes, I am giving you an offer, friends. You can get your hand-tailored suit for only $69.95 or $79.95, hand-tailored. And Mr. Tony is the man who's going to make that suit and make it just for you. Mr. Tony's custom tailoring. And let's see, where is Mr. Tony? Ah, Mr. Tony is located at 120 West 37th Street, NYC. 3053 Steinway Street, Astoria, Queens, 2087. Mr. Tony gets around. 2087 Coney Island Avenue in Brooklyn. Mr. Tony is ineffable. $135 suits for $69.95. Of course, there are other little things that you'll have to do. It's exciting. Speaking of the exciting... I'm sorry, Al. You know, you'd like to think that we're the only ones that have a touch of the skunk in us, the touch of the evil one, the touch of the devil. A lot of people like to think, you know, the poor little Peggy, for example, she has this idea that... I wish I could find it here. I guess I lost it again. Losing stuff here. Oh, yeah. She has this idea, a lot of people do, you know, that only mankind has evil in him. Well, I want to say that I have... Of course, I'd like to say that that's a nice romantic thought. It's a nice thought. But I suspect one of the reasons why so many animals are such good people is that they do not have any opportunities to make it good and big. No, they don't. They just don't have, you know... I mean, you're going to have a tough time, believe me, getting into a Third Avenue bar if you got claws and feathers on your head. You know, it just doesn't work. There's all kinds of discrimination, and that does not mean that they're not willing to pop, given the opportunity. Now, for example here, speaking of the gigantic human comedy, would you please bring on my human comedy music there? Let's go. No, human comedy. That's all right. Human comedy, Al. That's all. There we go. Although they're both human comedy. You know, you can look at it in either way you want. Daytona Beach, Florida, United Press. Drunken robins drove pet cats to cover here Tuesday, chirping the while something that sounded very much like, ha ha, whoopee, a very strange chirp. The birds had partaken voraciously of Daytona's palmetto tree berries, which had fermented all over the place. There was much perceptible teetering on branches for hours and a general all-around alcoholic bravado in the air. The robins took out after the birds, singing and yelling and hollering, and one even made a pass at a lovely chick that was moving down Miami Boulevard. See, I... No, you think that's anything? Listen here. Johannesburg, South Africa, harassed game rangers in South Africa's famed Kruger National Park today, at this very moment, are trying to cope with 1,750 tipsy out of their skull elephants. Did you hear about that? Well, they're having a fantastic time in Johannesburg. The whole herd is knocked out and screaming and yelling, fist fighting. The elephants have been disgracefully drunk for the past 5 weeks from eating the yellow fruit of the marula trees, which dot the game reserve. Elephants, it seems, rarely are mean drunks, but their alcoholic hijinks already have put one man in a hospital. Their annual binge has run to over 2 weeks. The marula bears fruit for 6 or 7 weeks each year, and the elephants apparently look forward to that time. It has a cloyingly sweet, very rich flavor. Africans use it to brew a particularly potent beverage. The elephants have a simpler process. They just lumber from tree to tree, stuffing the fruit down into their gullets. It ferments in their stomachs, and in no time they are pie-eyed. They wander, loaded, red-eyed through the park, waving their trunks happily from side to side and looking for more marulas. They rarely get aggressive, a National Parks Board spokesman said. They never get paralytically drunk. They just are like any human being after maybe 15 or 20 quick martinis. A tanked-up elephant, however, is an unpredictable beast. Like a human being in similar condition, there are those that, you know, decide that they're going to yell about what the Mets are doing, and there are those that just get on the muscle, you know? And an African, for example, railway worker is now recovering in a hospital from his encounter with an entire herd of pie-eyed pachyderms. Judas, which was his name, was riding his bicycle, a bit unsteadily himself, after drinking marula beer with some friends, when he came upon the elephants. They, too, had been knocking down marula juice for some time. The herd leader plucked Judas from his bicycle playfully. You know that kind of thing drunks do down there. Hey, what are you doing? They push you off the stool. You know, you hit your head on the spittoon. Tossed him into a bush, flattened his bicycle with one stamp of his massive drunken foot. Then he calmly turned to a nearby marula tree and knocked down 17 more Manhattans.
2 days later, near Kruger National Park headquarters, an African farmer narrowly escaped injury when his dog barked at a passing elephant bull who was under the influence. The bull glared blearily at the animal and then charged. The dog ran into his master's grass hut for safety, followed by the indignant elephant, pie-eyed, drunker than a coot. Moments later, the satisfied bull elephant lurched off into the bush with a complete grass hut around his neck, like a collar.
Now, you see, I don't know what Pegeen is going to make of that. I mean, nobody can accuse these guys of feeding the elephants the marula bushes. The elephants are just out there, and they look forward to it every year. It's elephant Mardi Gras time. So I'm going to have to say that the devil is in all of us. It does not spare the robins. It does not spare the cats. Of course, they have undoubtedly a different version of evil than we have, and they define it in a different way. It is true that cats do not have the same problems that we do in the way of evil. I don't know of any cat that's a pusher. Although cats, if you got to know cats, there must be some pretty rotten cats among cats that cats don't dig, you know? So it's pretty hard to tell which way it goes. Now, on the other hand, I wonder if a cat, you see, so let's take a cat who knows about cat evil. How would a cat judge human beings? I guess he would think they were all perfect. Because we don't do the rotten things, you know, that's defined rotten by cats. It's very hard. It's very difficult to know where it stops, you know? Because rottenness, you want to hear about the time I saw the Mephistopheles there open his door? Oh, that was a wild scene. Mephistopheles has this great scene with Faustus. Now, of course, this is a famous legend that has bugged mankind for centuries. And that's you might call it the cop-out legend or the sell-out legend. The assumption being that all of us have a certain set of moralities. You know, they're like iron-bound, and there they are. And somewhere there is this evil thing, this devil, the devil concept is found in every society in one way or another. It really is. It's found in every society. And now, even guys who don't believe in religions believe in the devil. Now, the devil takes different forms. By that, I mean it has different names. Let's put it that way. And so many a guy who does not believe in religion, he does not believe in what you could call a formal concept religion that involves God, involves a morality code, involves a devil, he will say that's all jazz. And that's a certain type. Now, that same guy will turn right around and he will define quite often the devil. He will call the devil society. He says rotten society, which is opposed to the good guy, the individual. The individual is the good guy. Society is the devil. And he really definitely has a devil. There is an evil devil. And that devil is always implacably evil and unexplainably evil. He never can explain why it is doing these things. He can never explain why society is evil, why it's after him, why it wants to destroy him, but it is a fact. He is being pursued by this evil, and it's called society. Now, in any given society, again using the word but in a different sense, in any given society, you will find that there is one thing that is called the evil. It is called the evil. Of course, that evil has many different faces. To many people, the evil is advancing communism. That's the devil. That's a true devil, and it's a devil which is implacable in its evil, and like all devils, by the way, magical. It can infiltrate any place. There is no way to combat it. It is always there, and you have to be constantly on the alert for it. This is a kind of magical devil who takes many forms, and it can be almost anything. It can be your kid's sister. It can be the telephone. It can be the cloud. It can be almost anything. It's magical, literally magical. Now, this devil, like all devils, has a purpose, of course. Now, the purpose is to destroy good, represented by you. That is the purpose, represented by the good people. And so the devil has set his sights on that, and he has no other reason for existence. Can't have any other reason, and if any other reason is given, that's all just hogwash. It's all icing on the cake. Now, that kind of devil is found in many, many societies. Now, I'm sure that in Russia, if you've ever listened to Russia on the shortwave band, you will find that their devil is another kind of devil. It is implacable. Their devil is even more all-inclusive than ours. Maybe perhaps because we have a freer society in one way, in many ways, that it is harder to show that we have this kind of devil. Their devil is unquestioned. It is absolutely there. Every newscast you hear, the devil comes into it. The devil enters sporting events, for example, even in Russia. The devil is there. And if a Russian soccer team loses to the British soccer team, it is because the imperialistic, warmongering immoralities were used in that game. That our beautiful, clean-limbed, honest, reliable, sober, industrious, beautiful athletes were undone once again by the unsportsmanlike conduct of the imperial warmongering devils. And they are magical, you see. You never can figure out how in the world they got to be a goalie on a Manchester hockey team, but the devil can be anything. And that's one of the magical things about devils. He can be almost anything you care to call him that way. Now then there's other kinds of that. Of course, there's the old kind. There's the old-fashioned devil that snorted flame and smoke and was in a place called hell. And this devil, once in a while, would make a foray out above ground or into the other world, which is where the good people lived. And his job was to subvert those good people. And, of course, the original concept of the devil was that he had originally been good. And he ran into a power struggle with the force of good, namely God or whatever, and he ran into a giant power struggle, and as a net result, he had fallen and has now devoted his entire world and his career and everything out. Does the devil have a career? I guess so. He has devoted his entire being to knocking down the force of good, which at one time he exemplified. You will find that this is also true of the devils in our political world. So many people will say, yes, they will say, the Russian people are good people. However, they are bound on an evil course. You see, they have fallen from grace. You will also find that is being said constantly in Russia. They say the same thing. We have no brief against the American people. The American people are good people. However, they are, and they are talking now, we are bound on an evil course. In short, we have fallen from grace, and by some inexplicable series of circumstances, have become led by evil people or evil system and have become evil, but we're basically good. And now then, what is the function of the good versus the evil? Well, it's, of course, to convert the evil to good. This is where we run into a lot of trouble. Now, the desire of many people to convert the devil to a good guy knows no bounds. It will go on and on. And so millions of people feel that what we should do is to convert the Russians away from being devils and make them into good people, because we know basically they are good people, and once we exorcise the devils from them, they will become, like all good people, good people. And they themselves, of course. It's scary to realize, and yet, in a way, part of that giant amusement park thing that's going on in the world, to find that the Russians, too, feel that they are going to finally exorcise the devils, the capitalistic warmongering devils from among our midst, and finally they will spring us from the trap. They will bring us out into the clear, beautiful light, and together we can march into the fields singing folk songs of good. So, exorcising devils has always been a great thing. That takes several forms, too. And I remember one day I'm backstage in the opera, and this is a famous Mephistopheles. And he was a famous Italian Mephistopheles, and he had this great holding a faith, tremendous basso, you know. The devil is always sung, and this is part of the devil concept. The devil is always masculine. He is exceedingly masculine. If you'll note, there's never been a devil that has problems with identity. This devil never goes around wearing bikinis and fluffy sweaters. This is never seen. A devil is really there, which gives you some insight as to what we call evil in this world today. But the devil is very definitely masculine, and he is not only masculine. You see, he is rampant in this masculinity, and furthermore, you'll notice that the devil never speaks in a high, squeaky voice. You can never picture the devil saying, "Oh, well, I'd like to. That is an awful idea." That is not the devil. That is Mr. Chucky, but not the devil. And so the devil always has a fantastic basso voice. And this particular devil came. You'd hear his. He would. You'd hear him in his little dressing room. And you'd see down there the little heroine, you know, the one that gets caught in the middle between Faust and the devil. You'd see this little girl down there, and she'd be, and you'd hear the tenor who is to sing Faustus. He'd be down there, and you hear this tenor down there, and way down at the end, you would hear the dressing room where the devil is going, 1, 2, 3, 4, many brave hearts are asleep in the deep, so beware. And you'd hear the devil down there, and the walls would shake, and this is the great devil warming up. Well, I'm backstage there, and I can hear the three of them lined up there, and boy, what a beautiful parable of good and evil, Al. It was right there. It was all spread out, and of course, unwittingly, these performers were showing you some of the things that we are afraid of vaguely. Have you always noticed that evil, no matter how it's drawn, when Picasso draws the evil in various drawings that he did back in the late 30s and early 40s in Guernica, evil is always shown as a rampant bull. It is never shown as a ewe. It is never shown ever as a fawn, a doe. It's never a doe. It's always a rampant bull. It's always some kind of a male animal, great, hairy. The centaurs and all these are evil. They're always male. So you see the evil down there warming up, and it's a quiet summer night. This happened to be a magnificent, actually, it was one of the best productions of Faustus I've ever seen. These were all top world-renowned artists. This was not local talent. These were people from La Scala and from the Munich Opera, and they were all there, you see, and it was a beautiful night, and the conductor was Fausto Cleva, and Fausto Cleva was down in the pit, and you could hear him warming up the orchestra there, and they were working away, and backstage with the soft summer air and the stars hanging over it, you could hear the devil warming up, and he really warmed up, and you'd hear him, la, 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 la. And it's booming out, you're boom, fantastic. And if the people are walking around, you know, the performers, they're out in the back there, and they hear the devil. And it was a wild scene to see, Al, and this was very, very enlightening. It was also not only enlightening, it was very educational. It can be two things, you know. And you saw this crowd of people in their summer dresses, and all the women are looking at this little dressing room. And nobody was paying any attention way down at the other end where the good guy, Faustus, is warming up. You can hear that tenor voice going, "Many, oh!
Polanyachi. And he's going out there. Nobody's paying any attention. And all the while, you could hear, rum-pa-ra. And that somebody, once in a while, you'd hear him talking to somebody who's in the control room or the place there with him. You see, you hear this deep, resonant voice. And so I walked up to the door. I had something to say to him. And I knocked on the door, and he says, come in. It's the devil. Well, it really was. See, I opened the door. Come in. Who is it? And I opened the door, and there he's sitting. He's sprawled out in this iron chair he had in there. He's a giant man. He must have been 6 feet six or seven. A world-famous basso. And who was at the absolute peak of his powers. He was about 6 feet seven. He had a flat stomach. He had a giant set of shoulders. He looked like a weightlifter. And he was wearing his full Mephistophelian costume. He was in makeup. And his eyes were long, narrow slits that almost went up to his ears. Big, narrow slits. And he had a sort of a grayish, dark red face. And he had this gigantic cape, black velvet cape that went all the way to the floor and sort of hung out behind him, and a blood red lining, a silk lining. And he has these tights, these black tights with these great pointy shoes. And he must have wore a size 14 or 15 shoes. And he's sitting there, and he's sort of sprawled out, and he has a great big finger of scotch there in his hand. Yeah, he is. He's warming up, see? And wow, I look there, and he's got this tight hat. You know, these very tight hats the devil wears with the peak that comes down between the eyebrows. And his eyebrows must have been at least 6 inches across, each one of them, all peaked up to a long, fuzzy peak, and waxed. Have you ever seen a guy with waxed eyebrows that are twirled at the end, that go up? And he had this goatee, which really was his goatee. This was not a costume. It really was his goatee. And it was a long, narrow goatee. And before for the performance, he had waxed it and shellacked it. And it sort of hung down, and he had these long sideburns that came all the way down past his cheekbones to the very tip of his goatee. And a thin, penciled mustache that was twirled out at the end, and he had these fantastic white teeth. And this guy sat there, and I opened the door, you know, and there I am. And the dresser has just finished, you know, giving him some the scotch or something. And the dresser, who's this old man, goes sort of scurrying out. And there I am, face to face with the devil himself. And there was this eerie moment when I felt, by God, this guy is not acting. He is sitting there, he had this leer in his eye, you know. He said, what is it? Boom, it comes out, what is it? I said, well, I have a... What do you want? I said, well, here. And I gave him a note, which Kleva had told me to give him. I give this note to him. He says, what does he want? What does he want? And he opens this thing. What, an idiot. Boom, down goes the scotch. Smoke comes out of the eyebrows. He takes that bottle, and a big square bottle of Chivas Regal. Boom! He goes, tell him, no. And he writes, no and no. Boom. He starts to go back into the envelope. I say, yes, sir. And I go scurrying out. Well, there he was, you see. Boy. Oh, my God. And I go running down to the pit, and there is Fausto Kleva. So Kleva is a gray-haired man. He's got, you know, big. He himself is a kind of a messed up Mephistophelian character, and I give him the notion, come on, he says some obscenity in Italian, and that was it. He bends over. Of course, he knows he's dealing with the devil, too, and there's no going back with that devil scene. Well, that night, I am sitting right over, I'm hanging. Let me tell you the opening of the thing. We are watching the opening of the opera, and of course, Fausto Kleva is directing down there, and the lights are flickering, and this is a fantastic set. This, to me, is one of the most exciting of all operas. Goethe's Faustus, Dr. Faustus. And you're the opening, and you see this old man sitting there on the stage, and he's singing. And it's the tenor. He's about 4 feet nine. He weighs roughly 92 pounds, and he's got these little blonde locks, and he's all made up to look old, you know. And there he's singing there, and he's singing, right, he's singing away there about how terrible it is to be old. And he walks around and he shakes. And boy, it's as phony as a $3 bill. He's walking around there and he's shaking and the lights are gray. And you see this old guy. And he's singing the Italian, the going lights. In Italian, he's singing away there. And he's struggling away. And he's making his pact with the devil. Then he sings his famous aria where he calls upon the devil to come down. He will sell his soul for youth, anything. Boy, he wants to be young again. He missed all the swinging and all that. And so he's been studying all his life, and he wanted to swing. Well, now that's the truth. That's the truth of a lot of guys. A lot of guys right now listening to this are sitting there. They're knee-deep in logarithms. They're knee-deep in abstruse theorems, and all the while the chicks are going past outside, you know. Well, this is the eternal story. This is why Faust is a great story. See, so here is this old guy now. He's 198 years old. He's about to go. And he has studied forgotten lore for all of his life, and the chicks have, you know, nothing's happened. He hasn't sung, yelled, and hollered, nothing. So now he is crying about this. When he makes this pact, the lights go... The lights are getting dark and dark. And I don't, you know, I know what's going to happen, but I'm not really quite prepared for it, because little did I realize this guy really thought he was the devil, and he is the son of a gun. I'll tell you some stories later when we get off the air. He really is. So the lights are going lower and lower, and Faustus is looking around, and boom! The orchestra gives this. There's a great thunder on the timpani. And the trap door opens, and 19 feet of the devil suddenly uncoil. It is my friend. And I am sitting 45 feet over the stage, high in the press box, you know, the box, the commentator bar. And I get this blast of scotch. Oh, man, you know that the real thing has arrived, and all the little ladies sitting there, you know, their little dresses sort of hang down, and, you know, they secretly think, oh, how terrible, and yet they want this guy to reach down and grab him and run with him, and he gets, and he stands up there, and he looks down on that poor little tenor, that poor little squirt. You know, he looked down, I'll tell you, this is the truth, this guy was 6'7". He looked down on that little tenor, and the little tenor looks up, and you could just see this tenor. He even got littler. He sort of scrunched down in his jerkin or his balkin or whatever it is they wear, you know, in these operas. He sort of looked up at the sky, and the devil goes, and he sings this fantastic aria, and his cape swirls, and the red lights are playing on him, and you knew from that instant on the devil is going to win. It doesn't make any difference. You can't fight it. The devil swirls his cape and the red lights go and the smoke flies. And this guy sort of, his eyes are white, you know, they're white and sort of an amused glint in them. He was obviously, the devil obviously has all the great lines. And not only that, the devil has all the fun. This devil really had swung in every possible conceivable way, and he was working on a new method even now. And you could see those eyes glaring. You get another blast of scotch that rolls out over the audience. The cape swirls. How much? Many. Yes, and you know who's going to win from the time the ball game starts.